From high school dropout to teenage wife and mother to university professor and public intellectual, Dr. Carol Swain is passionate about empowering others to raise their voices in the public square. We invite you to tune in to Be the People.
Are hate crimes in America on the rise? The news media often paints a portrait of rising hate crimes traceable to the election of President Trump or the mean-spiritedness of his bigoted supporters. When are hate crimes real, and when are they fabricated tales propagated by individuals and groups seeking to gain sympathy for a particular group or cause? And what is a hate crime anyway? Hate crimes include acts of violence committed against a person because of their race, color, religion, national origin, sexual orientation, gender, or gender identity. Now note that this definition does not include crimes committed against individuals who trigger other people by their support of a political candidate or political party. For example, the attacks on Trump supporters who attend rallies or wear Make America Great attire would not generally be considered a hate crime. My guest today, who's going to shed light on all of this, is Wilfred Riley. Wilfred is an associate professor of political science at Kentucky State University. He is the author of Hate Crime Hoax: How the Left is Selling a Fake Race War. He is also the author of Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About. What is perhaps most remarkable is the fact that Wilfred is a Black man and a tenured professor at a historically Black university. There's every indication that he has thrived as a scholar, even though his research touches on issues that the political left usually considers sacred cows. The Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal have both featured articles discussing his work. So join me today in welcoming Wilfred Riley to the Be the People show.
Dr. Swain, good to be on the air with you.
Well, it's great to have you on this show. And I'm very curious about, first, how long have you been at Kentucky State University, and were you tenured when you were hired?
No, I've been at Kentucky State for a total of about 5 years. I have a law degree from the University of Illinois College of Law, and I have a PhD from Southern Illinois University. And I got the second degree, which is a PhD in political science, in 2015 and went out on the job market. Did pretty well. Kentucky State is a state university. What appealed to me in particular is that it's a historically Black college located about 30 minutes from the Appalachian Mountains. So I thought, whether Black or white, this would be an actual chance to help kids, to do teaching that could be life impactful. But I've been here from 2015 on. I was not hired with tenure. I was hired on the tenure track, but as a standard assistant prof. I did go up early for tenure, and I got tenure about a year ago. But technically, I wasn't tenured when Hate Crime Hoax came out. I've been tenured through Taboo and so on.
Well, I understand the early tenure process, and I applaud you for being able to produce the kind of work that you do. In fact, I applaud your university, because there are very few universities where the administration would support someone that's doing research that would be, quote, controversial, especially in its critique of the left.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting there, actually, and I've said this quite a few times, we tend to define the country in terms of the opinions of the elite or the opinions of the coast. So, I mean, when we think of the climate on university campuses, we think generally about, say, the Claremont Colleges in California, Berkeley, the Ivy League, of course, maybe a bow of the head to the University of Chicago. I don't necessarily think that at the majority of the 5,000 colleges in the USA, if you're looking at the comprehensive, the ag schools, Texas A&M, the historically Black colleges, Kentucky State, there is that central Morehouse. There is kind of that same veil of censorship. And one thing I've noticed, actually, is that historically Black colleges tend not to be especially woke. Kentucky State has a very proud sort of Divine Nine fraternity scene. There's a great deal of campus gentlemanliness. Men literally aren't allowed in the women's dorms after 10 p.m., sort of that old Southern style. And there seems to be a little less guilt about being quote-unquote trad here than there would be at an equivalent primarily white institution. Because if you're on a college campus where the entire leadership team is upper-class Black guys, you don't have to breastbeat quite as much about the sins of your ancestors. So, I mean, at Kentucky State, the president, M. Christopher Brown, I mean, has been pretty supportive of my research, actually.
Great. I would love to meet him someday.
Well, you very well might. Kentucky State is definitely aware of 1776, the initiative we're working with. John Wood, one of the young brothers that's been networking with the project, is actually going to be here and at Eastern Kentucky in a couple weeks to speak to some Black men's groups, like 100 Black Men. So I think, I mean, there is a potential for synergy between some of the things we're doing in the historically Black colleges, for sure.
The topic that really caught my interest is your book on hate crime hoaxes. What was it that led you to take on that topic?
Well, I was intimately involved with a couple of these incidents. I mean, in Chicago, about 4 to 5 years ago, kind of a range of dates, we had a series of very, very high profile, nationally reported hate incidents. In, I believe, 2013, could have been 2012, a famous Chicago club called Velvet Rope Ultra Lounge. This was out on the suburban border with Oak Park. sort of a fern bar kind of location, very youth friendly. I have friends that used to go there to dance, very gay friendly. The bar burnt to the ground. And on the walls of this popular club were written these horrific anti-gay epithets. I mean, statements about violence toward gay people, just the words themselves, fag and so on, to use one of the less offensive ones. The presentation of this almost universally was that this popular night spot had been burnt to the ground by someone who hated gay people. So that was one of them.
Now, what year was this?
Velvet Rope Ultra Lounge, I believe early 2013, late 2012. That was the first of them. But within a very short period of time, there were quite a few. 2014, at the University of Chicago, you had an undergraduate named Derek Cockaline claim that he had been targeted by a literal hacker group called the UChicago Electronic Army, which had hacked his Facebook and LinkedIn profiles, or perhaps just his Facebook, because of his campus activism. They threatened him with rape. They threatened him with intense violence. That was a front page story in the Tribune. This ran for days. Down the road at Wisconsin Parkside, between those two incidents, and as you know, if you know Chicago, that's up at the end of our Metroplex, just over the Wisconsin border, there were literal nooses found scattered around the campus, and there were posted lists of death threats to every Black student on campus. I could go on. I mean, there was an incident at Michigan Tech. There was an incident at, I believe, U Detroit Mercy, a college where many Chicagoans go, six or seven in total.
I remember some of these incidents that you're talking about. And so the 2013 incident at the club in Chicago, that would have been during the Obama years.
Yep, nationally reported. It was reported in large part as a backlash to President Obama and gay rights initiatives and so on. This is about the time there was voting on ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. So yeah, that's exactly right. But of these incidents, I followed these. I took the Tribune in Chicago. I still do. I was a graduate student myself. So, I mean, this was happening in the student community. I mean, these were some of the elite grad schools in the area, U Wisconsin, U Chicago. I mean, this is international news. And what I noticed was that every single one of these incidents collapsed. I don't think that's an exaggeration. I mean, the Velvet Rope case was almost funny.
There was one at Columbia regarding a lady that apparently she hung a noose outside of her door after she was about to be fired. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, this was around the same time. And there were a bunch of these. I mean, when Obama was running, this probably would have been 2012, he's running for re-election. This is a campaign volunteer for the Republicans claimed that they'd been beaten up and they had a Barack Obama B carved into their face. They were criticized for being white and for supporting the wrong team. That turned out to be a fake. So this within that area was very high concentration of these sort of horrific claims, nooses on the door. But at least for the Chicago cases, these all turned out to be complete fakes. The Velvet Rope case, what actually happened was that the owner of the club was in debt, which can be a problem in Chicago. And he burnt his own bar to the ground to collect a sizable insurance settlement, as I recall, $150,000. And this was only revealed because a friend of his was captured for a felony DUI incident and went state's evidence. But the insurance boys came after him, cops came after him. That was revealed as a total fraud, one of the highest profile hate crime cases in recent history, at least in the Midwest.
Well, let me ask you this. When they arrested the owner for burning down his own building, how much media coverage did the arrest get?
Virtually none. I found out about the arrest from the Insurance Fraud Times, I believe, from one of the business papers I sometimes read. It's quite literally perhaps a hundredth of the coverage of the initial. And this is very common, as you know. And I mean, that's the question. Yes. Very often you see these cases appear on the front page. Erica Thomas, for example, the Georgia rep who claimed she was violently assaulted in an upper end grocery store. I mean, that again was an international story. It turned out that the person responsible said nothing racist and was actually a Cuban American leftist. And again, you saw about a tenth as much coverage of the debunking as you saw the initial story. So very often you see one of these stories go internationally viral, one, be debunked, two, but the debunking will be covered, three, on, you know, page 26 of the leisure and pet cats section of the paper. But Derek Cockaline, the University of Chicago kid, that also turned out to be a fake. I mean, you can do a simple IP address trace. He simply messaged himself from another Facebook page, this horrible stuff. Wisconsin Parkside, the person who did almost all of the quote-unquote hate incidents on campus was a Black undergrad trying to raise awareness, just so on down the line. And I became very curious because, again, and you just mentioned you remember these cases. This was a situation where six or so of these cases had become nationally famous or more within maybe 2 years in my own city. And that kind of drove the question of how often does this happen, of at least the high-profile hate crime cases are fakes.
Well, Wilfred, if you had been Caucasian, do you think you would have been able to write a book that's received as much attention as your book has?
I think that's a great way of phrasing the question. No, I think I would have been able to write the book. It's a free country. You can do anything. You can self-publish with Amazon. But I think actually we saw what happened. And I don't think he'd mind me talking about this. I'm fairly friendly with this guy. There's a guy named Laird Wilcox, who is a researcher of extremist movements on left and right.
Yes, I know his work quite well.
Yeah, over there at U Kansas. Now, Mr. Wilcox wrote this book 20 years ago. He looked through all of the hate crime hoaxes in his era for about 5 years before him. Now, obviously, I don't think my book's a derivative. You're looking at modern tech and so on, but it's very similar. I mean, he found that in 5 years, there'd been about 400 of these hoaxes. He found them to be concentrated among certain groups, campus radicals, working class African Americans, many of the same things I found. And he attempted to publish this book. And a fairly edgy press essentially initially agreed to publish it and then said, we just can't do this. And the book still kind of lives on in limbo. It's called Crying Wolf. I've given it a shout out multiple times. It still sells fairly well on Amazon, but it's in kind of that spiral bound format that you see for academic monographs. A publisher was never found. And the idea, I think, was that it would be too poisonous for this white guy, burly conservative guy, beard, to be seen as the author of this. Whereas Hate Crime Hoax became a bestseller. So, I mean, if I stood on anyone's shoulders, I think it was probably his. And yes, it would be much, much harder if I were me, but Caucasian, you know, conservative, golfing, basketball playing, big guy, but I were also a white guy identified with the right. It would have been very difficult to write this book.
I think you're right. And we're going to take a brief break. And when I return, there's some more questions I have for you.
Each week, the Be the People show presents interviews with insightful guests from the world of politics, religion, media, and culture. The Be the People show is on podcast. It offers bonus footage. To listen to Be the People online, go to the BeThePeopleNews.com website and subscribe to the Be the People podcast, heard also on the America Out Loud Network.
I'm back with my guest, Wilfred Riley, and we are discussing hate group hoaxes. And so, Wilfred, we both agree that a white guy writing the same book would not have gotten the kind of attention, or people would have been afraid to touch the book. My question for you now has to do with the Southern Poverty Law Center. Are you on their watch list now?
No, actually, that's one of my goals, though, I will say. I jokingly told a friend a couple of years ago, before my debate with Jared Taylor, before some debates with leftists, that the ideal for me would be to be named to the alt-right's Judas Watch list of the most dangerous people on the left and the SPLC's list of the most dangerous people on the right. And if you Google me, I made Judas Watch about 2 years ago, so I'm halfway there. So if the SPLC is listening, mention that I am a crazy extremist and I will achieve a lifelong dream. And of course, the reason I'm comparing those two lists on the fringe is that the SPLC is on the fringe. The SPLC, I think, has a fairly good racket going to some extent in that they pretend to be a mainstream, content-neutral watchdog that targets hate. But in fact, with the exception of a few of the more extreme Black Muslim and Black Hebrew factions, what they do to a very large extent is list players on the center-right as extremists and nutjobs.
Well, you know, they started doing that over immigration, and I believe that I'm the first person to point out that instead of monitoring hate groups, the Southern Poverty Law Center had become one, and that was in an op-ed in 2009 when they went after Lou Dobbs and some of the immigration restrictionists. They started labeling them, and then eventually they labeled me as a sympathizer for white supremacy.
Well, I'll probably use that line and credit you when I discuss the SPLC. That's interesting and funny.
Apologist for white supremacy. I'm an apologist, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center.
But not yourself a black white supremacist.
No, they use the expression apologist because of my book on white nationalism and a film that I reviewed that was titled A Conversation on Race. And I was not sufficiently critical of the filmmaker. And so that was how I was labeled by them. But really, the attack started after I published my opinion piece.
I don't find that unusual that, I mean, you know, well-known right-of-center academic Carol Swain is considered a white nationalist, or we don't need to exaggerate, a sympathizer with white nationalism apologist. I mean, if you actually look at the people that are declared to be extremists by the Southern Poverty Law Center, it's an interesting multicolored range. I mean, Michelle Malkin, who is pretty far right, but who's Filipina, just made the list. Laura Ingraham, I believe. I mean, Majid Nawaz, the counterterrorism consultant, actually sued them because they described him as an opponent of Islam. And he said, well, no, I'm a professional opponent of radical Muslim terrorism. That's my job. I'm Majid Nawaz. You can't present me as a racist. And he won something like $2 million from them. But in the proceedings of that legal case, which I've read pretty much word for word, you see all of the people that they've named, like Center for Immigration Studies is considered a racist entity. The absolutely mainstream center-right think tank, allegedly someone on their board once had white nationalist sympathies. Who else is there? I mean, the Family Research Council, the second largest Christian group in the country because their views on gays. So this is the equivalent of someone taking HuffPo or the Daily Coast and saying, you know, what they've said about Southerners crosses a certain line. This is a hate group. I obviously don't think Majid Nawaz or the CIS is a hate group in any sane threat preparation professional's analysis. I don't think anyone thinks Family Research Council is going to start planting bombs. So SPLC presents itself as extremely mainstream, but is in fact a voice from the hard political left. And I think people are becoming more and more aware of that.
Even if people are becoming more and more aware of it, it doesn't prevent the mainstream media from going to them as a trusted source.
Yeah, that's an issue. I mean, when I became active in politics, my initial impression was that conservatives were, quote unquote, working the refs, as we used to say in sports. I mean, that people were talking constantly about media bias to get more favorable coverage. But if you actually look at some of the empirical studies out there, I mean, obviously the right-wing media, Fox or Rush, I mean, that's not perfectly unbiased either. But the mainstream left-wing media, definitely has a very strong slant. I mean, I believe it was Pew Research in 2004 that found that 93% of mainstream media journalists were either leftists, liberals, or left-leaning moderates. At very most, 7% were conservatives of any kind, including libertarians, Tea Party types, if that existed at that time, you know, advocates of traditionalism and so on. So, I mean, I think that that does affect coverage. When you're reading the Washington Post, I mean, you're reading a very well put together, but left-positioned periodical.
That was not always the case for the Washington Post. 20 years ago, they were pretty much moderate in the middle. And so whatever's happened there has happened, I would say, in the last decade.
And as a political scientist, as you are, I mean, we've read the polarization research. I mean, both political parties are becoming much more polarized, and the polarization is more intensive on the left. So, I mean, I believe it was Stein a couple of years ago dropped a piece that actually received a fair amount of reporting. A headline you can find it under is "Leftists 3 or 4 times more likely to unfriend on social media." But his conclusion was that leftists were becoming more liberally identified. They were becoming less tolerant of conservative friends and romantic partners. You started seeing this reflected in, for example, local media. And the same thing now is happening on the right. I mean, the alt-right, quote unquote, is essentially just working class white identity politics. And that's a backlash in very large part to minority identity politics, which have gone on pretty much unchallenged since the 1970s. So yeah, it doesn't surprise me that this has intensified in recent years. I mean, even the data I'm using is less than 15 years old, if you're talking about the Pew study. Most people don't necessarily recognize, unless they study politics, that CNN leans more than a bit left.
Hopefully people are figuring that out, and also figuring out that Fox is not totally to the right.
If you look at a standard political scale, I mean, Fox would be center right to right. MSNBC would be left. I mean, fairly far left. Rachel Maddow and so on might identify as socialist. But yeah, I mean, CNN would be at very least center left. People might be picking that up more and more. But I think that this is one of the reasons that there's so much attention given to, for example, the 1619 Project. The 1619 Project is, in any reasonable sense of that term, a far-left academic initiative.
To explain to the listeners what it is.
Sure. 1619 is the idea that all of America is due to slavery, basically. It's a series of essays that ran in the New York Times that put kind of Black history at the very center of American history, the reason we eat so much sugar, slavery, reason for capitalism being so competitive here, slave markets, so on down the line. But, I mean, that's obviously a fringe left perspective, that Blacks alone built, say, 60% of America. That is presented as absolutely mainstream. And I think that's allowed because most people don't know the actual political positioning of the New York Times or the SPLC.
Well, the other part of it, too, is that it seems like we don't counter false narratives at all because there's such a pushback from the left that people are afraid of being accused of racism if they tackle anything that might be critical of a position that's being advanced mostly by Blacks. And with the New York Times, they have just legitimized revisionist history.
Yeah, the New York Times legitimized a largely Marxist, Afrocentrist view of history, the idea that Blacks were the group that was responsible in a majority percentage for building America. That's an absolutely non-mainstream point of view, although I'm very proud of our ancestors. I mean, Black people were, until recently, 8 or 9% of the population. So no, that's not something that most people think or ever have thought. It's the imprimatur of the times that makes that a respectable position, quote unquote, a position worth listening to.
Okay, we need to take a break. And when we return, I want to get back to your book on hate crime hoaxes.
Would your business or organization like to reach an audience of world changers? Be the People, a radio show hosted by Dr. Carol Swain on WFYL Radio, is looking for new sponsors for this Philadelphia suburb. We reach over 61,000 people. Visit BeThePeopleNews.com and click Contact Us or call 615-310-8617. That's BeThePeopleNews.com and click Contact Us or call 615-310-8617.
I'm back with my guest, Wilfred Riley. And Wilfred, tell us about your conclusions or enough about your book that our listeners can decide whether or not it's something they want to run out and purchase.
Sounds good. This is the first book to take a large in look at the phenomenon of hoax hate crimes to be published by a major press. I mean, Regnery, the massive right of center publishing house, obviously available Amazon, wherever else fine books are sold. But what I do is look at the different categories of hate crime hoaxing. So I take a look at all of these college campus social justice hate hoaxes, many of which, like Duke Lacrosse, are completely unbelievable. Although you could argue that was more of a rape hoax, but also Goucher College, Drake University, Wisconsin Parkside, no shortage. I take a look at what I call Klan Springs Eternal hate hoaxes, where African-Americans or other people of color essentially make up assaults from white racists to excuse their own crimes or battles with mental illness or whatever. I take a look at the absolute epidemic of hate hoaxes that surrounded the election of President Trump.
Tell us, how often does it happen that you find people that are members of the victim group concocting hate crimes?
Well, my estimate is that almost 15% of hate crimes are definite or probable hoaxes. The way I get to that, first of all, I have a data set of around 700 of these hoax hate incidents, which is available to anybody to request it from me. If you Google Wilfred Riley, you'll find my Facebook, Twitter, so on. So this isn't a joke, and this isn't one or two things I pulled off some conservative Reddit thread. I mean, there are nearly 1,000 of these. And to put that in context, these are concentrated in the past 5 years. That's when they're almost all found. Laird Wilcox, as I said, got similar numbers over a similar period of time. Good piece of research there. So if you look at the total number of hate crimes in the country, there are less than 7,000 felony or serious misdemeanor hate crimes reported in a typical year, right? Of those, maybe 1 in 10 receives the kind of media coverage that would let an ethical scholar, which I am, track it to conclusion and put it in a data set. So out of 700 widely reported hate crimes per year, these are the murders and the beatings and so on, you know, I find that over 5 years, 600 are fake. You can do the math yourself, and I mean, that's a close to 20% rate of proven false reporting. And I would add to that, by the way, all of the other cases aren't convictions. There's a great set of California data on this where they look at all the reported hate crimes in a typical year. This is some kind of investigative panel inside the government. They look at all the hate crimes reported in a typical year. They're nearly 1,000. They draw, you know, doom-filled conclusions. But if you keep reading through the data, only about 300 of those were even reported to the prosecutor, a very basic standard, meaning the cops know it's not a fake and they have a suspect, as you know. Only 200 of those were pursued to prosecution. 55 produced convictions. The numbers might be off.
Let me ask you this. How many, none of those hate crimes, I suppose, are ones where you would have people attacked because of their political party or the clothes that they wear?
Yeah, no, good point. I mean, so that gets into the idea, the definition of a hate crime is very narrow and specific. So a hate crime is a crime where someone is attacked because of animus based on race. I mean, I think at this point you have to put sex and gender in here, religion, a few other things. Some states include, say, veteran status. But no, attacks based on social class. So a high school fight between working class and rich kids, those are never hate crimes. Attacks based on political affiliation, like the surge of attacks on Trump supporters. And I'm sure more than a few counterattacks of people in, say, Che Guevara t-shirts, Antifa, the Proud Boys. None of that is even definable as a hate crime. So there's some real questions about whether we should have hate crime laws at all. I.e., for example, if you were to attack me because I'm black or a male, okay, that's almost certainly a hate crime. If you were to attack me because I am an independent voter and you think that I should always vote Republican, that's not a hate crime. So whether that makes sense is up to the individual analyst.
Well, it seems to me that a lot of the crimes that are making the news now, or at least the conservative news, are attacks by Antifa or some group like that on Trump supporters.
Yeah, and to a lesser extent, vice versa. But yes, I mean, one of the things that you see in America right now is what I call political gangbanging, where since the Tea Party and the Occupy movements developed around the same time, 2010 through 2012 in America, you've seen armed, stylized political factions fighting in the streets. And as any German could tell you, that's not generally a good thing. Antifa is one of the worst offenders here. I mean, there are entire cities on the West Coast like Portland and Seattle where, you know, I don't live there, but Antifa seems to have taken over pretty sizable districts of the city. And yeah, this is your point, I think. Any attack on a Trump supporter by a 200-strong mob of Antifa fighters would not be a hate crime. Now, that legally could not be a hate crime in most cities.
Well, the other thing that people complain about are minority on white crimes, that they are less likely to be considered a hate crime.
That's probably true. Now, I do think there are two lines of approach here. First of all, I recently wrote a piece for Commentary Magazine making the point that there's no race war in the USA, nor one likely to arise in the near future. So if you actually look at minority on white crime, which is the bugaboo of a lot of the hard online right, where you have websites with names like White Girl Hurt So Bad, I mean, there's not a great deal of that. Like, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics report in 2018, from, you know, a pro-law and order Republican administration, African-Americans make up around 14% of the country and are 15% of those who attack whites. Whites attack blacks even less often. It was a bit under 20% of the time.
These mob attacks that we see on the internet where there will be a lone white person, sometimes an elderly person, and a group of black teens will either rob that person or beat them to unconsciousness. How often does that happen?
Extremely, extremely rarely. So all of those things, I'm not disregarding the fact that crime is bad. I mean, I teach some of our criminal justice courses. I'm a pistol instructor for the NRA. Hate criminals. But at the same time, we've got to recognize, brutal as those incidents are, I mean, again, the data from the Trump administration, which isn't friendly to street criminals, is pretty clear on its face. I mean, black people, around 14% of the pop, 15.2%, I believe, of those that attack whites. So every one of those incidents would fall into that 14%. I don't think that we should deny they exist, but I also think it's a bit irresponsible to take every one of those and put them on a list and say, don't walk downtown without your machine gun. That's just likely to prompt interracial fighting between young Bravos of both colors. There's one valid point here, though, that quote-unquote dissidents have, and that is that the media never covers these cases. This was one of the most stunning things I found in hate crime hoax, actually. If you look at entire areas of coverage, so for example, if you look at police shootings, 75% of the people shot by the cops are Caucasian. Whites, Caucasian, Hispanics, there's very little black overrepresentation even before you get into crime rates. only 10% of media coverage, as far as I could tell, is directed at this 80% of cases. So if you Google well-known police shooting, my research associate did this, and I think what she found, in fact, I know what she found, was 2 Hispanic cases, 4 white cases, and 32 black cases. So there's an incredible focus on cases like the Michael Brown shooting, which was fully justified, where had the victim been Caucasian and middle class, I think we all know there would have been no coverage, there would have been local coverage, Google Dylan Noble. So that is a valid point. It's the same thing with interracial crime. There's not a lot of interracial crime on either side because criminals in general aren't fools, although they're bad people.
Is that true of violent crime and street crime?
The one exception is robbery. But I mean, again, when you look at the Bureau of Justice statistics and you get that 14%, 15% metric, that's only looking at index mostly violent crimes. The one nonviolent crime would be, I believe, burglary. But with the exception of robbery, which black people do commit more often than the norm, and we need to recognize that, but most crimes are intraracial. If you look at murder, the old joke is that the person most likely to kill you is your ex-wife. But that's actually not really a joke. I mean, 85% of white murder victims and an unbelievable 95% of black murder victims are killed by someone of the same race. Again, I think that the point the hard right has about this is the media coverage is wildly unfair. These interracial crimes occur at the same rate, or if anything, we whites are victimized more. But the media makes it sound as though there's a war against people of color. Now, that's a fair point. But in terms of your actual risk of getting murdered, I mean, the person most likely to kill you is the person sleeping next to you in bed.
Yeah, I think people know that. But I think when it comes to violent street crime, the FBI data that I have seen would suggest that a disproportionate amount of that is committed by people of color.
Well, sure. Yeah, no one denies that there's a crime problem in the black community. Now, there actually is a response to this, which is that overall, poor whites have problems with significantly more pathologies. And they tend, again, to be ignored because those in the media don't care about and dislike, quote unquote, deplorables, which is actually a conservative point.
But we're running out of time for the podcast. And so I want to give you some time to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you.
Yeah, I'm in that just short of famous category. So I will talk to you and debate with you online. I'm Wilfred Riley on Facebook. That's W-I-L-F-R-E-D-R-E-I-L-L-Y, as Dr. Swain has pointed out. I am same thing, same name on Twitter. You can also find me as Will_DA_BEAST630 on the Twitter. I'm pretty active on both. I have across various pages 40, 50,000 plus Facebook followers, although not all under my name, a couple thousand on Twitter. Yeah, feel free to reach out, talk to me. If you Google Wilfred Riley, you'll also find my email and so on down the line. So I'd love to engage with people.
Okay, Wilfred, I appreciate so much your being on the Be the People show. Remember, it's up to us, the We the People, mentioned in the preamble of the Constitution, to be the people who change our nation and our world. And one way to do that is to get information. And so today we've talked about hate crime hoaxes and issues that relate to race. We can applaud Wilfred Riley for having the courage to take on some very important issues that there needs more discussion about in this country. Until next time.
Be the People is brought to you by Carol Swain Enterprises, LLC. You can hear this podcast again and learn more about Carol at www.bethepeoplenews.com. Again, that's www.bethepeoplenews.com.
If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and heal their land. 2 Chronicles 7:14. WFYL reminds you to pray for America.